Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel Uncle Tom's Cabin poses all kinds of problems for readers, historical, political, literary. Uncle Tom was the best-selling novel of the 19th century. Abraham Lincoln called it the book that started this great war. James Baldwin called it just a very bad novel, while Edmund Wilson described it as a much more impressive work than one has ever been allowed to suspect. The novel was and may still be a social phenomenon, and it remains one of the most discussed books in American history. Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Hollis Robbins' new annotated edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin enters the literary fray from all sides and finds the truth in the margins. We'll talk to them both about how this much maligned and much praised book. Later in the hour, we'll talk to the director of an IMAX film about making his movie in the middle of Hurricane Katrina. But first, what does Uncle Tom's Cabin mean to you? Is it the novel, the long series of images that it spawned? Is it the Black Power insult of the 1960s? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Henry Louis Gates Jr. joins us from the studios of our member station in Boston, WBUR, where he chairs the African and African American Studies Department at Harvard. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be back.
And Hollis Robbins is co-editor of the book. She's a member of the faculty at the Peabody Institute at Johns Hopkins. She joins us by phone from Jackson, Mississippi. Nice to have you on the program as well.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And Mr. Gates, I wanted to start with your very first annotation about Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that's about the different subtitles that this book had at various times.
Yes, that's right. The Man That Was a Thing. Think about how profound that was, because, of course, that's what slavery tried to do. It tried to objectify human beings. It took away our ancestors' names, even. It grouped them with the chickens and the cows and the pigs and the horses. You couldn't even appear by two names in a federal census until 1870, if you were formerly a slave of slave descent, precisely to objectify you and make you a thing.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the other titles that she considered?
Well, in the English language versions, they've got they published it variously under Slave Life in America, A Tale of Life Among the Lowly, The History of a Christian Slave. I think those subtitles were more a matter of selling the book, situating it so that the reader would know what it was going to be about, since it's only a very little bit about the cabin.
Yes, indeed.
yeah, that's right. And in fact, when even though she changed the name or minimized that aspect of the name when she published it in book form, after it had been serialized, of course, in the national era, she still kept that phrase in the first chapter. She used it several times, that this man resisted being turned into a thing, or these slaveholders were attempting to turn a man into a thing. It was a very powerful notion, because often my students ask me, Neil, how could anyone who interacted with a slave have thought that they weren't actually a human being?
Right.
But many of the apologists for slavery argued that. You know, remember the Great Chain of Being? Many, many people starting in the 18th century argued that persons of African descent were, as a result of polygenesis, not descended from the same, as it were, Adam and Eve as Europeans, and in fact had more in common with the animal kingdom than they did with human beings. Even Thomas Jefferson, in Query 14 of Notes on the State of Virginia, said that, and this is almost a direct quote, that the orangutan prefers African females over his own female of the species, suggesting that Africans and orangutans slept together. That's Thomas Jefferson, the father of the Declaration of Independence, and probably the father of Sally Hemings' children.
Well, let me ask you both, though, about reading, or I suspect rereading. And I know, Henry Louis Gates, you wrote in the introduction, of course, you'd read it before, and I suspect that's true of Hollis Robbins as well. But what was it? The first thing you had to do when entering this project was presumably go back and reread the book.
Oh, absolutely. For me, now, as I mentioned in the introduction, I first read it in the eighth grade. But I first became aware of Uncle Tom's Cabin watching The Little Rascals. And Eliza escaping across the ice floes was both hilariously funny and very, very moving for me. And in fact, doing this research, Hollis and I looked at a lot of the film versions, including mm-hmm. The Little Rascals. But it was it was full of surprises for me. The biggest surprise for me was that the transformation of Uncle Tom from an almost mythical hero to black people, a transformation from that hero status to become the ultimate term of race betrayal, is one of the great mysteries and ironies in African-American history, Neil, and it happened in 1919. We can even pinpoint. Do you know that Frederick Douglass, writing in 1892, Du Bois, writing in 1903, James Weldon Johnson, writing in his autobiography Along This Way, all hailed Uncle Tom as one of the great works of American literature and one of the best things that ever happened for the cause of African-American people. Frederick Douglass wrote that in the midst of these slave troubles came the book known as Uncle Tom's Cabin, a work of marvelous depth and power. Nothing, Douglass continues, could have better suited the moral and humane requirements of the hour. Its effect was amazing, instantaneous, and universal. Now, that was Frederick Douglass, and as we point out in the book, Douglass reviewed this book, talked about this book over and over in Frederick Douglass's paper, his own newspaper, between 1852 and 1854, and even defended it when a black man, Martin Delaney, who's one of the fathers of black nationalism, who claimed he hadn't read it, but was basing his opinion on his wife's opinion. He wrote in and said, remember in Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, Mrs. Stowe says that it's Uncle Tom is based on the figure of Josiah Henson, who wrote his own slave narrative. And Martin Delaney writes in and says, if it was based on Josiah Henson, maybe Mrs. Stowe should give Josiah Henson the royalties. And Douglass fought with Martin Delaney and fought everybody who would, and believe me, no other black person traduced this book. The only people who were criticizing Mrs. Stowe in the pages of Frederick Douglass and most of the other press in the North were apologists for slavery.
And but what then, happened in 1919?
Well, 1919, the strangest thing happened. In an address, yeah, you remember Marcus Garvey.
Sure.
Now, Marcus Garvey is the modern father of Pan-Africanism, and Marcus Garvey came from Jamaica in 1915 looking for Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington was his hero, but Booker T. Washington died in 1915, and Garvey went on to found the United Negro Improvement Association, and Garvey became the most populist black nationalist in the history of black nationalism, without a doubt. And at his rally, first of all, Garvey enunciated this concept in 1919, saying, the old-time Negro is gone, buried with Uncle Tom. And then at a rally on August 7th, 1920, one of his lieutenants, the Reverend George Alexander McGuire, declared, and I quote, the Uncle Tom nigger has got to go, and his place must be taken by the new leader of the Negro race, not a black man with a white heart, but a black man with a black heart. And that was the beginning. And it culminated, of course, with Malcolm X. And Malcolm X, in 1963, famously called Martin Luther King and Uncle Tom. And it wounded King. Malcolm X said, just as Uncle Tom, back during slavery, used to keep the Negroes from resisting the Bloodhound or resisting the Ku Klux Klan by teaching them to love their enemy or pray for those who use them spitefully, today Martin Luther King is just a 20th century or modern Uncle Tom or religious Uncle Tom who is doing the same thing today to keep Negroes defenseless in the face of an attack that Uncle Tom did on the plantation to keep those Negroes defenseless in the face of the attacks of the Klan in that day. The irony, Neil, is that Uncle Tom didn't do any of this.
No.
Uncle Tom was a hero. Uncle Tom sacrificed himself twice. He refused to flog a slave named Lucy that Simon Legree wanted him to flog at great risk to himself. I mean, he was beaten severely because of that. And finally, he was beaten to death because he wouldn't reveal the location of two black women, both mulattoes, who had escaped and who were hiding in the attic of Simon Legree's mansion. He knew where they were. He wouldn't give them up. And so Simon Legree had him beaten to death and killed. Mm-hmm. How did this transformation occur?
Well, let's see if we can get some listeners in on the conversation. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. We're discussing the annotated edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin with its co-editors, Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Hollis Robbins. And let's talk with Lindis. Lindis is on the line with us from Prescott, Arizona.
Yes. I hope I can get everything in and make sense of this. First of all, I lived in Los Angeles for many years. I was an actress, and I was in a play about Uncle Tom. I played Cassie, mm-hmm. and we had tremendous difficulty getting black actors. The minute they knew what the play was, they said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't read the book, I'm ashamed to admit, and I was surprised because I believed that Uncle Tom was a good person. Anyway, that was that. We did the show, and
what year was that?
In the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And?
The reason I asked
is I left L.A., and I moved to Scottsdale, and then I came to Prescott. I picked up a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin 6 months ago. I
hope it was
could
our
not
copy.
Put the book down. It is extraordinary. Uncle Tom is the most amazingly wonderful person you could ever imagine. I mean, even the introduction by someone called Alfred Kazin says that Uncle Tom is a Jesus figure. Mm-hmm. And he is. He believed so strongly in his idea of God that nothing, and believe me, I'm not a church person, nothing would come between him and God.
In fact,
he
ma'am,
was incredible. I was up 24 hours reading this book,
well,
crying my eyes out the whole time, and I thought, this is the most amazing thing I've ever read.
And we'll get a response from Henry Louis Gates when we come back from a break, because we're just about out of time. So hang on the line with us, will you, Lindis?
Pardon?
Can you hang on the line over the break?
Sure.
All right, I'll put you on hold if I can find the right button, for once I did. All right, we'll be back with Lindis, our caller from Prescott, Arizona, also with Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Hollis Robbins, co-editors of the annotated Uncle Tom's Cabin. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're discussing today the new annotated edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin with its two editors, Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Hollis Robbins. Henry Louis Gates Jr. is the chair of the African and African American Studies Department at Harvard. Hollis Robbins, member of the faculty at the Peabody Institute at Johns Hopkins, still with us on the line. This is Lindis calling us from Prescott, Arizona, just before the break. Henry Louis Gates, she was explaining to us that she, after appearing in a play about the book, actually read it 6 months ago, and I found it to be a revelation.
Well, Hollis and I did a book event, a marvelous book event, at the New York Public Library about a month ago, I guess. And the last question asked from the audience was this: who would I characterize as being an Uncle Tom today? Meaning, not in a derogatory sense. And Neil, we have to come back to mm-hmm. explain why this shift from Uncle Tom being a hero within the black community to being a term of derogation, why that came about. But I was really, and they looked at me and they wanted me to come up with somebody. And the person who, ironically enough, comes closest in my mind to conforming to the characteristics and beliefs of Uncle Tom was none other than Martin Luther King himself. Martin Luther King, think about it, sacrificed himself for his people, just like Uncle Tom did. He was a deeply religious, devout Christian. He wasn't self-serving. He was large of heart and generous of spirit. I mean, if there was a 20th century Uncle Tom, it was Martin Luther King, but not in the sense of Malcolm X. Malcolm X intended it, in the sense that Harriet Beecher Stowe drew the character. Wouldn't you agree, Hollis?
I think that's absolutely right, though I'm glad you're actually embracing your answer this time. because I think people were a little shocked that anybody would, even now after our book, when people have started reading it, that it's hard to get the heads around the idea that Uncle Tom is actually a lovely character, just mm-hmm. like our caller just said, that mm-hmm. he's good, he's kind, he's gentle. And Stowe was very deliberate in her characterization of him, though he's obviously an uneducated person, and he speaks in dialect, except when he's quoting the Bible. Mm-hmm. His English is beautiful. His English is perfect. And she really wanted him to be seen as a speaker of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the problems, I think, that contemporary readers, particularly African-American readers, and Neil, you have to remember, we did this book to recuperate Uncle Tom's Cabin for the African-American community, for a new African-American reader, in the same way that my dear friend and colleague Jane Tompkins and many other feminists in the 70s and 80s writing about Harriet Beecher Stowe recuperated her for feminists. No one had done that, though black people have written about this book extensively. There wasn't an edition that had done that sufficiently, and that was at least my motivation for doing it. But one of the problems with trying to get young black readers to read the whole book is
the first two words, Uncle Tom.
Yeah, well, yeah, but, you know, the word nigger is used 11 times in the first chapter. There's all kind of unconscious racism. For example, in chapter 6, which is called Discovery, she says, very soon, about a dozen young imps were roosting like so many crows on the veranda railings, each one determined to be the first one to apprise the strange master of his ill luck. And then, won't he swear, said little black Jake. Yes, he does swear, said woolly-haired Mandy. You know, it's all that woolly-haired and all that blackness and that, which is certainly partaking of racial attitudes at that time. But contemporary black readers have a hard time getting over that. I figure that if we could annotate that out and get them through that, they could realize how profound an effect, as James Weldon Johnson said in 1933, this
Can
book
I
has had.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, go ahead, please, Linda.
I just want to say, yes, Tom was good and kind and compassionate, but he was also enormously strong, both physically and mentally.
He was.
I mean, he was a powerful figure. Mm-hmm. And after 24 hours of reading this, I thought, oh, good God, if only we had him in the White House, what a different world this would be. I mean, this man, he's extraordinary.
Well, it's very interesting.
You read the book. Yes, there are, and I'm white, and I'm, you know, it's hard to put myself in the place of blacks. And I read some of those things, and yeah, they make your skin crawl. But you have to say, it was written in that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Harriet Beecher Stowe must have been an amazing woman to write this when, you know, when slavery was an accepted part of life.
Well, and it didn't bother contemporary black readers. That's what's the most curious thing of all. Don't you agree, Hollis?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the illustrators of the era, the early illustrators, show depict Uncle Tom exactly as you describe him.
Yeah.
Strong, brawny, barrel-chested, the kind of man that is a manly, manly man.
Yeah. And yet we have this image of this doddering, old, white-haired, bald guy.
Well, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, that was the later illustrators, especially in the scenes with little Eva sitting on her lap, on his lap.
Yeah.
Right.
Suddenly
he
became bespectacled. He had bent over, gray hair, balding, because the idea of this brawny, strapping black man with a small young blonde sitting on his lap just wasn't going to do during Reconstruction.
Lindis, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And ironically, Neil, those images, those transformations occurred precise at the end of Reconstruction and in a period called Redemption, and then when Jim Crow is instituted legally in the 1890s, there's a proliferation literally of tens of thousands of what we call Sambo art. Derogatory images of black people stealing chickens and watermelons with big, thick lips and mispronouncing the king's English, almost to put the genie back in the box, because black people had never enjoyed as much power in this country as they did between 1866 and 1876, radical Reconstruction. So there was a massive attempt to redefine the public image of the African-American, and Uncle Tom took it on the chin, along with every other image of a black person because of that.
Well, representations of the novel have pervaded American culture since its publication. This is a recording of a man named Len Spencer reading the flogging scene from Uncle Tom's Cabin back in 1904.
Wow.
Now, Tom, I mean to promote you. I am going to make a slave driver of you here. Take this confairy gal, Emmeline, who don't want to be a lady, and flog her, you hear? Flog her! I hope master won't set me back. I ain't used to it. I never did it in our camp nowhere. What? You can't? Well, you will before I've done with you.
Clearly did not spend a lot of money in the special effects department.
But that's great.
Yeah, but that's sort of the audio equivalent, isn't it? Do you think, Hollis Robbins, of those Pickaninny figures?
Oh, absolutely. That's actually, I hadn't heard that. That's wonderful. But the she had a, she was not only made fun or had caricatures of black and white, but of rich and poor. And rereading it again over the weekend, I was realizing just in the first page that she has a hand fetish, and whatever the class of person, white, black, rich, poor, anybody who's poor has big, ugly, thick, coarse hands. Mm-hmm. And she describes Simon Legree's hand, especially in some of the whipping scenes, as just a big, ham-fisted, he loves just hitting slaves with his big hands.
I was amazed in Henry Louis Gates, of course, reading the annotated version. I was forced to read the book for the first time.
Good.
Simon Legree doesn't show up until almost the end.
I know, but he's so memorably bad and evil that that's a character who looms large. But he is. But weren't you surprised at how Cassie tricks him by going up into the attic and pretending to be Ghost, that big bad Simon Legree could be faked out by these two black women hiding up in the attic just above his head?
Yeah, and that basically, not that that would happen, but that it would happen in a novel published then, yes, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And but we need to go back to why this transformation happened. Why could Uncle Tom become this term of abuse? And you know what happened, Neil?
Hmm?
Something called the Great Migration. And
The Second World War.
That's right. Well, it's really started about 1910. But in 1910, there were about 480,000 black people living in the North. By 1920, there were almost 700,000. And by 1930, there were 1.1 million black people living in the North. What happened was black people, a rural Southern people, became an urban Northern people. And this created one of the biggest clashes of within the race of class. The old established black people in the North looked at these rural, basically illiterate, pre-industrial migrants coming up from the South, and they were horrified of them. I mean, they wanted to draw a distinction between them and us, as it were. And that is precisely when the term became one of abuse. They started to referring to these migrants as Aunt Janes and Uncle Toms. And, you know, they hadn't had a lot of direct contact with white people. They didn't look white people in the eye. And so they became a metaphor of a passive kind of black person. And in 1919, the year that Garvey enunciates his theory of the Uncle Tom, that's the summer of, it's called the Red Summer, summer of race riots, because of the soldiers. Black soldiers coming back from Europe in World War I demanded equal rights. All these factors blended together to create this phenomenon, and poor Uncle Tom was the person or the character who suffered because of it.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and this is Jane. Jane with us from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to suggest a contrarian point of view. Why the term Uncle Tom might, in fact, really be accurately considered derogatory by black civil rights leaders. And that is, at that time, the notion of, you know, the super black, really the kind of black individual who was, you know, perfect in the eyes of, perfect and therefore acceptable in the eyes of whites, really became something that was you know, racist in its own way.
You mean like Sidney Poitier and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Yeah, I can barely hear you, but yes, exactly right. And, you know, that was the only way that whites could found, you know, black men to be palatable, as if they were, you know, somehow superior super beings. And that's sort of the interpretation as a white person that... You know, I always considered Uncle Tom to reflect.
Well, it's interesting that that's called, in literature, that's called the Noble Savage Convention or the Noble Negro Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And George Harris, remember George Harris in the novel? He's very, very noble. I mean, George Harris is a black man. He's a mulatto. But he fights back. He fights the white man. I mean, when he's being pursued by the slave catchers, he shoots. He defends himself. So, and then finally, and this was the part of the book, the only part of the book that disturbed Frederick Douglass, he repatriates to Liberia. He becomes a colonist.
Uh-huh.
You know, he leaves the country. And Mrs. Stowe apologized for that later and said that if she wrote the book again, she would leave that part of the book out.
Marcus Garvey must have liked that part.
Yeah, Marcus Garvey loved that part.
Thanks very much for the call, Jane.
Sure.
We're talking with the co-editors of a new annotated edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin. They are Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Hollis Robbins. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Phil. Phil on the line with us from Honolulu.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning where you are. Good afternoon where we are.
Yeah, I wish I were in Honolulu, Phil. Not in 21-degree Boston.
First of all, I really honor and so pleased to hear this discussion, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
When I was coming into my young manhood back in the late 60s, there were two books that I read. One was Uncle Tom's Cabin, and the other one was Nigger by Dick Gregory.
Oh, I loved Nigger by Dick Gregory. I wrote about it in my memoir, Colored People.
Oh, when I read that, I think I was 17 years old, maybe. It just turned my head around.
Yeah, me too. I did a report on it in my class at school, and the teacher wouldn't say the name out loud. It was a battle of wills between us.
I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. She said, thank you for your report on... Mm.
I gave the book to my son, and I said, here, take this book, read it. Don't leave it laying around, because someone will see the title and make all kinds of assumptions about the book and about you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... in a similar way, that has happened with Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that over the years, and I'm a middle-aged black man, I have heard Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom, but the Uncle Tom that people were talking about was not the Uncle Tom that I read in the book.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And much of what I think has happened, and I'm not a literary scholar by any means, but once, what I think has happened is that there have been so many generations of folk who have heard that phrase, Uncle Tom, in such a disparaging way that just people just make the assumption that that's what Uncle Tom was.
Absolutely. I'm sure Malcolm X never read this book. If he had read the book.
That was my thought, yes.
Yeah, he never read the book. Nobody's read. Black people stopped reading this book. That's why Hollis and I have edited this, and we hope to revitalize interest in the black community. What we need is a good, honest movie about Uncle Tom's Cabin with a very compelling protagonist, and I hope that will happen soon, a Hollywood movie.
That would be exciting.
Yeah.
There have been a few versions, one with, I guess, Phyllis Rashad and one with Eartha Kitt, but they haven't been quite dramatic enough.
Now, Neil, who would you cast as Uncle Tom? See, I want to ask you a question.
As Uncle Tom, Denzel Washington is not big enough.
Well, or how about, was Jamie Foxx big enough? I've never seen Jamie in person.
Well, Jamie played a bunch of athletes. You'd have to think he'd be big enough.
Yeah, and Will Smith played Muhammad Ali.
And Will Smith played Muhammad Ali, yeah.
You probably
what
have to give him.
What about James Earl Jones?
I think he's too old.
Too old.
Point. Yeah,
Remember, Uncle Tom's got three little kids. That's what we write about in the introduction, Neil. The fact that he's desexualized. And even for James Baldwin, when he wrote his famous essay, the 1951 essay, he didn't realize how sexually powerful Uncle Tom is in the novel.
Though Stowe works very, very hard to make sure we don't see it, I think it keeps emerging. The sexuality keeps emerging, not just with Uncle Tom, but all the different marriages, all the women who are always attractive, who are attracted to their husbands, whose white men ogling at them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very sexual book.
Phil, we have to let you go. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you again for the discussion.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
And Henry Louis Gates, we know you have to leave as well, probably something unimportant like a class or something you've got to teach.
Not on a holiday. Unfortunately, it's a memorial service for my dear friend Lisa, a film about my dear friend Lisa Goldberg, the head of the Revson Foundation, who recently departed. So I'm sorry I have to go.
All right. We thank you for your time. Hollis Robbins, though, is going to stay with us to take a couple of more of your calls on Uncle Tom's Cabin. When we come back from a break, we're also going to be talking about a new film called Hurricane on the Bayou, made in IMAX during the hurricane. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking with Hollis Robbins, co-editor of the annotated Uncle Tom's Cabin, a member of the faculty at the Peabody Institute at Johns Hopkins. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. And email is talk@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Merle. Merle with us from Galloway in New Jersey.
Yes. I'd like to, I'm sort of glad that Professor Gates left, because I want to take this in a little less intellectual direction. And that was how I was affected by the portrayal of Uncle Tom's Cabin in the show The King and I, which really spoke to the dignity of man as a whole.
The small house of Uncle Thomas.
Yes.
What affected you about that, or is that, was that?
I thought it was a wonderful parallel. Mm-hmm. It was a way of bringing home exactly what, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein had in all of their plays, if you look at a subtext of the dignity of mankind.
And it's interesting that in the introduction to the book, Hollis Robbins, it's written that though the facts as presented in the Little House of Uncle Thomas in the movie are all wrong, that somehow they managed to get the metaphor right.
They get it exactly right, that it's about whatever you need to do to leave, whatever you need to do to be free, whatever you need to do to escape from the shackles that are both emotional and physical shackles there, which is, I think, the better parallel for Anna and the King of Siam as well, especially given the strange domestic makeup of the palace there with all those various children and not a sort of monogamous family structure, which was part of Stowe's critique of slavery, what there was no nuclear family, or a nuclear family kept getting
shattered,
exploded. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm really, as an elementary school teacher, I'm really enjoying this discussion.
Okay, Merle, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
May I ask you a question, Neil?
Sure, go ahead.
What, you had never read it before this book?
I had never read it before being asked to be assigned it to do this this interview, yes.
Why do you think that is?
I think because it fell so far out of favor in the 1950s when I grew up and was going to grammar school. By the end of the 1950s, the book was completely out of favor, and I never saw a reason to read it, I'm embarrassed to say. And now that I've read it, I've had, of course, revise all of my thinking about what the fundamental nature of the book was, and indeed what the fundamental character of Uncle Tom was. But let me, in the course of answering your question, ask you one, and that is, does anybody read Uncle Tom's Cabin today?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, that's I came to it in graduate school at Princeton, was assigned it in a 19th century literature class, and like one of the previous callers said, it's a book that you don't want to leave lying around. It's a book you have to explain. You know, why are you reading that?
Yes.
And it was very surprising in The New Yorker, John Updike confessed that he had never read it. Nobody seems to have read it. And I was surprised the first time I read it. I thought, well, hey, this isn't half bad. It's actually quite good.
It's a little turgid in spots.
It's a little turgid. Was there any spot that particularly surprised you, or?
It was seemingly there's the vivid villain, as Professor Gates pointed out, Simon Legree, and why anybody would keep him in their pocket for so long offended me dramatically. I mean, you want to wheel him out a little bit earlier, things might have gotten a little more exciting.
Well, and it's very interesting how she keeps the sex at bay. And I think in a very, very interesting ways with Legree. I mean, clearly he wants Emmeline when he buys Emmeline, mm-hmm. for what he has had Cassie for a mistress. But every time he's about to get close to her and you get the specter of some pretty dramatic sexual violence, she gets him drunk or she gets him sort of concerned about superstition. Then his evil is, even though, of course, at the end he flogs Tom's death, his evil is very latent, very looming and very frightening. He doesn't explode.
Let's see if we get one last caller in on the conversation. Let's ask Teresa to join us. Teresa calling us from San Jose in California.
Yeah, hello?
Hi.
Hello. Hi. I'm reminded in your discussion, first of all, let me tell you how much I appreciate seeing great works of literature reexamined. But I was reminded as you were talking, or I saw a parallel to the character of Jim in Huckleberry Finn.
Yes.
He's often been characterized and caricatured as sort of the ignorant, superstitious black man, and sadly, I think Toni Morrison has even written, you know, a tract about how that book should be struck off the canon. But in fact, if you actually, you know, read the book, Jim is the one and perhaps the most moral character in the book. He is a father figure to Huck. He teaches Huck ethics and morality, and yet he's really known, I think, in the same way that you're discussing Uncle Tom, in a much different light.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you had any feelings about that character.
I think a lot more people read Huckleberry Finn, but go ahead, Hollis Robbins.
Well, I think that's an excellent parallel. And I think one of the things that Stowe was trying to do, and I'm not sure about Twain, but Twain's dislike of religious doctrine, of this doctrinaire idea that you had to believe to a certain sect, you had to be baptized, you had to have agreed to this or that doctrine in order to go to heaven. That Stowe embraced the idea of natural goodness and a natural Christianity. And in this way, she was sort of thumbing her nose at her father, her doctrinaire father. That Uncle Tom is unschooled like Jim, and yet utterly humane and utterly good. But at the same time, I would agree with you that sort of utter goodness, Christianity, Christ-like figure sits very uneasily with the superstition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. But Jim is the only person who actually teaches Huck to be unselfish, and tells him when Huck famously plays the trick on him that he's dead, and he says to Huck, that there is trash to treat your friends that way. And the fact that Twain puts this black runaway slave in the place of Huck's father is quite amazing to me, always has been, and I hate to see the book trashed.
Now, when did you first read Uncle Tom's Cabin?
I read Uncle Tom's Cabin years and years ago when I was in junior high, I think. I would certainly agree with your characterization of it. I don't find it a particularly great book, not in terms of, you know, not artistically, but certainly the fact that it's probably the first book to see African-American characters as fully realized human beings with their own lives and their own families. It's a real, you know, turning point in literature, and I think it's terrific that you're reexamining it and bringing it back into the public consciousness.
Teresa, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
And Hollis Robbins, thank you so much for your time today.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Hollis Robbins, co-editor of the annotated Uncle Tom's Cabin and a member of the faculty at the Peabody Institute at Johns Hopkins. When we come back, Hurricane on the Bayou.